Welcome to Kingston Reid's Word to the Wise podcast series for HR and safety professionals.
Welcome to the second podcast in our series coinciding with National Safe Work Month. If you missed our last podcast, Psychosocial Risks, A Trip Through the Quagmire, it is available anywhere you listen to your podcasts. Today, Kingston Reid safety team is going through reasonable belief and statutory notices, The Quagmire Strikes Back. My name is Liam Fraser. I'm a partner in our Brisbane office, and joining me is John Macris, our National Head of Safety and Regulatory Practice, and Michael Stutley, a partner from WA. Gents, how are you doing today?
Liam, John Macris here. Thanks very much for the intro. Yeah, look, great topic. We're certainly in a cycle of regulator compliance and enforcement at the moment, so I think this is a really, really important topic for our listeners.
Yeah, thanks guys. I'm really looking forward to diving into this one because it's such an unknown space with so many variables. Let's do it.
Well, let's not waste any time. The topic that we're going to talk about today is one that John, Michael and I talk about quite a bit with clients, and it's about regulators and inspectors' reasonable belief, statutory notices and the regulator's approach to both physical and psychosocial hazards. So, gents, any comments that you have generally about the safety regulatory approach during National Safe Work Month that you're seeing from the regulators?
I think from my perspective, as I mentioned earlier, we're certainly seeing a lot of activity. You know, the regulator's got various functions and they include education and compliance and checking compliance, but we are seeing more of the, certainly the compliance and enforcement than the other stuff. So I expect them to come out. We'll see lots more education during this month being National Safety Month, but certainly seeing the other side quite a bit.
Yeah, look, I echo John's comments there. I think education, as we know, is an important piece of any regulatory activity. And when it comes to issues like psychosocial risks and reasonable belief, these are things that are relatively new. And we really do need to ensure that if compliance is going to be effective, then at least people are educated about what they're complying with.
Yeah, I think that's a great call out, Michael. And probably because it's something that we as a group are all very familiar with, I thought I'd just take a couple of moments to step through some of the powers that regulators and inspectors actually have. And unless you're really interesting like us and have the opportunity to look at the Work Health and Safety Acts around the nation very often, you're probably not super familiar with what the powers of the regulator are. The regulators under most of the harmonised jurisdictions will pretty much always have the power to do all things necessary or convenient to be done in connection with the regulator's functions. And that's going to be, like John was saying, to advise and make recommendations on enforcement of the Act, monitor compliance, provide advice on health and safety to duty holders, and collect, analyse, publish statistics on health and safety and a whole range of other things. So regulators have a very, very broad power. In each jurisdiction, the regulator is going to be a little bit different, but broadly speaking, the regulator has all of those powers under the harmonised laws. And particularly what we also see is the power that's used by regulators most often is their information gathering power, which is under Section 155, which we'll talk about in a moment. But it is a power that we don't think gets talked about enough, because a lot of regulators use it in very broad circumstances for duty holders when they're really trying to ascertain compliance with the Act or with work health and safety duties. And it can be a very powerful tool used by regulators to conduct very broad and sweeping inquiries that, if you're not careful, you can land yourself in a spot of bother if you say the wrong thing. The other thing to talk about is the power of inspectors. So inspectors get appointed by the regulator, and inspectors generally have quite powerful powers to use when enforcing compliance with the Act and to seek entry to places, any workplaces, and they can also require the production of information and people to answer questions. That's that section under 171 under the harmonised laws. And that's one that we'll talk about a bit in a moment, particularly in how it's exercised and whether inspectors have a reasonable belief when they're exercising them. But just broadly speaking, the powers the regulators have and inspectors have are incredibly broad. Regulators can monitor compliance and enforcement of WHS laws in state or Commonwealth, depending on which your jurisdiction is. And inspectors are generally the ones who will be empowered to come out and visit your workplaces. And if you were following our last podcast, we talked about some of the things that we're seeing when inspectors come out for psychosocial hazards. But generally, when they're coming out to look at hazards, they're responding to incidents or reports of hazards and risks. They can assist with resolving WHS disputes if you've got one of those. monitoring compliance with WHS laws. They'll investigate breaches, and they can, if they're feeling particularly nice, give you advice and assistance with your WHS duties. Inspectors are able to enter workplaces, and that raises the question around what is a workplace, which again is incredibly broadly defined under the various harmonised laws. So there is, generally speaking, a very wide obligation on duty holders to assist the regulator and inspectors when they're coming to seek those powers. So, John, did you have anything that you're seeing from your perspective in the exercise of powers by regulators and how they're going about that?
Yeah, in New South Wales, we're seeing quite active inspectors coming out investigating. And as you'll be familiar, Liam, they can come out and look at issues, even if they're not coming out for that particular issue. So they've come out to investigate or look at compliance about one issue. And as they walk you through, they identify another issue. They can certainly address that and ask questions or make inquiries in relation to that issue. We're seeing, particularly in New South Wales, the inspectors going out, looking at issues, and then inquiring about the employer or the PCBU's processes around managing psychosocial risks. So what have you got in place to manage psychosocial risks? There is talk of them using a psychosocial checklist when they're going out to workplaces. I haven't seen one yet, but I'm waiting to see one. Another interesting development we're seeing in New South Wales is, rather than doing interviews where they sit down and they formally exercise powers, being their entry powers, usually under 171, they're asking for meetings. And particularly in the psychosocial space, we're seeing them having meetings and talking about whether someone's raised a psychosocial concern or otherwise, and they're not being called interviews, but then they're proceeding along the same way via asking a series of questions. I was in one recently. We sat down, we were told it was a meeting, and then I counted 130 questions. So, you know, they're quasi-interviews in the form of a meeting. And in my mind, Liam, it's, you know, do they have the power to come in? Yes. Are they exercising that power? And then, well, what are we doing to manage that activity, and how are people protecting themselves with the protections that are available in the legislation?
And that raises all sorts of issues, doesn't it, John? I mean, just as you were describing that, I was thinking, well, there's insurance consequences that possibly flow from that, you know, in relation to volunteering information. There's the loss of the statutory protection potentially. And I think our listeners really need to be alive to the fact that this is happening. And I'm sure it's not isolated to New South Wales. Liam, you mentioned the powers of inspectors. And I just want to recap some of those powers for our listeners, because they actually are quite broad. And sometimes, you know, you might have this misconception that an inspector on site might be limited in terms of what he or she can do, but actually they can inspect anything on the workplace. You know, they can look at documents, they look at plant or equipment, they can bring to the workplace and use any equipment or materials that they deem necessary. They can take measurements, they can conduct tests, make recordings, sketches. They can take and remove for analysis any samples of substance. And mind you, they can do that without paying for it. They can require a person at a workplace to provide reasonable help, take documents and information, obviously those that aren't subject to legal professional privilege, and of course issue notices for improvement, prohibition, prevention, cleanup, etc. So the question really is, look, what compliance and enforcement powers do regulators and inspectors actually have?
Yeah, when you look at that list, Michael, they're incredibly broad powers. And of course, the most common ones are either to seek documents or ask questions or get information, which is usually asking questions. And their powers, you know, it's a legal requirement. You've got to produce the documents or give them the information. So typically we see them either coming in on entry, or if they come in on entry, it's a 171 power. They've got 30 days to exercise that. If they're not in the workplace or haven't been there for 30 days, they use Section 155, and some of our listeners will have received 155s. They're quite common at the moment, and they've got the power to issue that to a person or the organisation if they have reasonable grounds to believe that that person or organisation can provide information or documents. And it's a pretty broad power. When you look at these notices, they're quite broad. Other powers that commonly come across, particularly after an incident, is a prohibition notice, which is really a stop work exercise. It directs either an individual or an organisation to stop carrying out that work, and that's a hard stop. That's not a, look, can I get the job finished and can I run that machine for a bit longer? That's a stop work right now. There's a serious risk or an immediate or imminent exposure to a hazard. And so that's a pretty serious one. And you've got to stop work until the inspector's satisfied that you can restart work without that risk continuing. And there's no time frame on those. If you want to take 6 months, the inspectors are happy to wait 6 months until you can show that you can restart that activity. The other probably more common notice, although they tend to go together, is an improvement notice. And that's if the inspector reasonably believes that someone's contravening provision of the Act or the regs, or has contravened in circumstances where that contravention is likely to continue or be repeated. And we probably see more improvement notices than prohibition notices. And they can include things like directions or measures that have to be taken to remedy. Those improvement notices typically have a time frame. You know, they can be 14 days or longer. They can be extended with the discussions with the inspectors. And in the psychosocial space, probably that's the one we're seeing the most of. The inspector's issuing a 155 notice for information. That information is replied to or provided. And typically we're seeing that being followed up by an improvement notice.
Yeah, I think that's a great call out, John, that we're seeing just across the board more interest from regulators about psychosocial hazards and risks and how they're being managed, including an increase in notices to produce documents and provide information, and that specific 155 power being used to issue it to companies or corporations to get that information. I think what I'm getting is a lot of questions from clients about the reasonable belief requirement when statutory notices are issued. So, John, Michael, can either of you elaborate on this concept about reasonable belief?
Yeah, the legislation's full of the word reasonable, isn't it? And they're really important words. A reasonable belief is a belief that, based on the existence of facts which are sufficient to induce the state of mind in a reasonable person, and the inspector's required to balance really objective information that they get with their own views or subjective views. So there's this objective and subjective element to, you know, is there adequate information for the inspector to form a view. The inspector has to make reasonable inquiries, and you know, we see this arising often where we get a 155 notice, the information's provided, there hasn't really been a real consideration of what's been provided, and then we see improvement notices issued relatively quickly, and you've got to ask yourself, has there been reasonable inquiries in relation to the time frame that's elapsed? So that's one example where we're seeing it. The inspectors can't make assumptions, and without, you know, seeing their decision making, which you typically only see if you review one of these notices, it's really hard to see, you know, what they've relied on. But the reasonable belief has to be based on all the evidence that's available and to the inspector at the time they issued the notice. So, you know, there has to be an inquiry by the regulator to satisfy themselves that there's this condition or this particular circumstance.
John is spot on here in terms of what reasonable belief is. You often see in statutory notices, or you should see, the basis for an inspector's reasonable belief. But sometimes it's very difficult to understand how an inspector could have possibly arrived there. And I'm sure you both know exactly what I'm talking about here. It's just like high school math. You know, you need to show your workings, and the thought process is critical. And assumptions, you know, John, you mentioned assumptions there, but they really are the elephants in the logic. It usually results from the lack of reasonable inquiries being made, which undermines the entire concept of reasonable belief, in my opinion.
Yeah, so we tend to understand that before regulators or inspectors have this power to issue most of these statutory notices, that they've got to have this reasonable belief first. But I think, given what we've just been talking about, there's always a couple of challenges. And one of the things is that I see is the notices themselves say that the reasonable belief was held by the person issuing the notice. And this is going to be a particular challenge where it relates to a psychosocial hazard or a specific psychosocial risk for an individual, especially where that might involve that individual worker's medical information or a diagnosis of some description. So that's going to be an interesting one. And the other kind of challenge that we're seeing is how could a person or a PCBU comply with an improvement notice or a prohibition notice related to those psychosocial hazards where it is very individualised and it's relying on potential medical information that maybe isn't shared. So there's some real issues around that. But more broadly, if we're to say, you know, what are the challenges and what can we do around statutory notices? John, Michael, what are you seeing in your practices?
Yeah, Liam, I think one of the things around notices is you've got to look at them really carefully and assess what is being said is the issue and what is the direction that's being given. Certainly, statutory notices can be reviewed if there's a good basis for saying that there wasn't a reasonable belief or they're unclear. You know, in some cases, you can have a conversation with the inspector to say, you know, can you clarify what you mean here? In other cases, you're told that's what it is. And, you know, there's always this issue around, did the inspector make reasonable inquiries with workers or review the relevant documents? We often get 155 notices where we reply to the specific request. There are other documents that haven't been asked for that could address further the issue but haven't been asked for. And should they be asked for, you know, is it reasonable for the inspector to ask the extra question rather than issue the notice? Reviews, initially an internal review process. So you go back to the regulator, to a different inspector, to give it a clean look over to make sure that the initial inspector formed the right views. If you're unsuccessful in that internal review process, then you can go to the relevant tribunal or commission for an external review. And that's a formal legal process, like that's a formal court process. And that the commission or the tribunal has the power to confirm, vary or set aside the actual notice that's been issued. And being a court process, it is involving, you know, you've got to make applications. You typically have to think about whether you need a stay, and those stays are really important because otherwise the notice can keep running. So prohibition notice is a classic one. You do need to seek a stay. You need that because otherwise you can't do the activity. And then it's a whole court process. You've got to prepare evidence, put on affidavits, put on supporting material, and get ready for hearing. It is quite a very important and detailed and a legal process, but one that, whilst it shouldn't be undertaken lightly, one that's very important, particularly if, you know, the sense is that the right considerations haven't gone into the decision-making of the inspector.
Yeah, to John's point here, I think we will see many more challenges to improvement and prohibition notices for this very reason. I think that anything particularly issued in relation to psychosocial risk, just because of the sheer breadth of the matters that could amount to a psychosocial hazard, and to some extent, the subjective assessment on whether it may cause psychological harm. And take, for example, a prohibition notice issued in respect of performance improvement processes at a particular workplace, and let's say it's done so on the basis of it being a psychosocial hazard. An extreme example, I know, but how does a PCBU properly comply with such a notice? To my mind, the question is the consequence for PCBUs that performance concerns can no longer be addressed going forward or need to be risk assessed on every single occasion, taking away resources from where they should otherwise be deployed? I know there's a number of questions in those statements, but and perhaps rhetorical questions, but effectively, this is the quagmire that we find ourselves in.
I think there's some really interesting rhetorical questions that you asked there, Michael, but from my perspective, I think we've got this understanding of regulator and inspector's powers to issue statutory notices and some of the difficulties with complying with them. And I think what the challenges are going to be going forward are this tension between the physical hazards that we can see and then the psychosocial hazards, and how they are going to, you know, potentially change the evolving way that statutory notices are issued. So probably brings us to an important point around the implications of compliance with statutory notices when they're issued, and what happens if a PCBU doesn't do what they need to comply.
Yeah, that's a good question. And it's actually an interesting dilemma that employers have, or PCBUs have, because typically we find that, you know, if you don't comply, it's actually an offence, a separate offence under the legislation. In the context of a prohibition notice, the workplace or the activity can be shut down. And that raises other questions. If you perform that activity in a different workplace, do you need to shut it down in the other workplace, given the statutory notice is probably issued to a different workplace? If you conduct the activity in one state the same way that you do it in other states, and that's shut down in one state, what are your obligations to do something about that in the other jurisdiction, even though the law's a state law and this notice only applies in one jurisdiction? So it raises all sorts of really important and interesting questions. The improvement notices imply that a person's contravening or has contravened the legislation, and these are, of course, criminal contraventions. So taking steps to do something about it could mean you may be making an admission, but if you don't take steps, you're actually leaving something potentially unsafe. The regulators, the inspectors, prosecutors often take the position that any changes made as a result of responding to a notice is evidence of a contravention. So I think people really need to tread carefully through these notices.
And that's a really important point that you've just raised there, John. And to complicate it just a little bit further, We also have things called recommendations, which can appear in notices, and sometimes they're even included in the absence of any actual directions in the notice. And while strictly speaking, non-compliance with recommendations does not carry the same consequence that you've just described, John, it can certainly have longer-term consequences if subsequent and similar notices are issued, or worse yet, a prosecution is commenced. I guess safe to say, as with a lot of what we've discussed, get advice early, understand what is required from the notice and whether there are any other necessary avenues or considerations.
Yeah, I think that's a great call out, Michael, and it's probably something to end this podcast on is probably some observations and some predictions. I think my observations are, from what we've just been discussing, that statutory notices are actually very important. They're often the first step in the enforcement life cycle, so you really do need to get advice on that pretty much straight away. I thought we could end with a couple of predictions for the future in this space specifically. My prediction, probably a pretty easy one, is that I reckon we'll continue to see the battle lines drawn in the form of statutory notices and challenges to them, and then the potential compliance activities and prosecutions being used by the regulators around those statutory notices. So I reckon we're going to continue to see that as an evolving area as we go ahead. John, do you have any predictions?
Yeah, Liam, I think following on from that, I think my prediction is going to be that people are really going to have to look at these notices very carefully and consider what does it mean taking actions to comply versus challenge those. We'll see it particularly in the psychosocial space where, you know, if things aren't addressed, we'll see enforcement action. So, yeah, I think really careful consideration of notices moving forward.
And Michael?
Yeah, look, I'm going to be a bit more dire in my prediction, and I predict that we're going to see the weaponization of psychosocial hazards, both from a work health safety perspective, but also from an employment perspective. And this will unfortunately play out in a couple of rounds before we get any real certainty.
Always uplifting to end on something like that note. But I wanted to say thanks to the listeners for joining us today. This has been the second of our National Safe Work Month podcasts. Thank you for joining us. I've been Liam Fraser, partner at Kingston Reid in our Brisbane office. And really appreciate the time that you've taken to join us today.
Yep, stay tuned, folks, because October is going to be a big month for us, coinciding with National Safe Work Month, as we roll out our next podcast in the Safety and Regulatory series.
Yeah, and our third session, our last session in the series, will be an Around the Grounds wrap-up of safety developments across Australia and our FOC predictions of 2025. So thank you for joining us and look forward to chatting to you soon. Mm-hmm.